This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Gathering activities. Human intelligence, putting soldiers on the ground in places where soldiers normally didn't go to spy, to kill, to all these things. So you saw this convergence over the last 10, 11 years between what the CIA does and what the Pentagon does.
And the conflicts have really been pretty tremendous between the CIA and the Pentagon at different times. And in fact, they've had overlapping operations that both didn't know about. Is that correct? And a lot of funding that has been put into both of them with no oversight.
Right. I mean, if you have both the CIA and the Pentagon, each answers to different parts of Congress, so each congressional committee. So there's been times when one would be doing one and telling their part of Congress or their committee. The other would sometimes tell their committee. The committees wouldn't talk to each other. There was just as little communication between various congressional committees in order to perform oversight as there was between the CIA and the Pentagon themselves. So what does that really mean? What's the implication? The implication is what was happening in the early to mid part of the last decade was you would have military spies going into countries, not telling the American ambassador, not telling the CIA station chief. They would be sort of running into each other. They were trying to be recruiting the same sources. You had teams that Rumsfeld sent to places like Paraguay, where one team was sent to an embassy to gather intelligence and ended up having to get spirited out of the country very quickly after two of them got into a bar fight and one of them pulled a gun. So it was some haphazard activity. And then in about 2005 and 2006, I write about in one chapter how they tried to get together and sort of what they ended up in fact doing was carving up the world where they said, okay, the CIA is going to be in charge here, the Pentagon's going to be in charge here. So you saw more collaboration, but then in also places where, like for instance in Yemen today, you also have redundancy where you have the CIA running a drone war and the Pentagon running a drone war.
And the personalities were part of this, but somewhere in the middle were the centers. There was Bush to begin with, and then there was Obama. Do you see any real difference in the way that they've approached this transformation? It seems to me that the technological advances have been as rapid as well, and those were called for. I mean, a lot of money was dumped immediately after 9/11 into this, and some of it resulted in real things like more drones, better drones, better cameras, more camera, you know, all of that kind of thing. Can you talk about, where we are now with that a little bit?
How that impacted
the changing transformation and the roles of the two?
Yeah. So, if you listened closely to President Obama during his first campaign, he talked about, again, how the Iraq War was a disaster. He talked about, committing more resources to Afghanistan. But he certainly didn't seem like he was going to shut down the drone program. He said he would go hunt Osama bin Laden. He would kill terrorists in Pakistan. People, though, still were surprised, including many reporters, about the extent to which he has embraced this sort of clandestine secret warfare and the escalation of drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen and elsewhere. Part of it is, I think, the mentality of the administration is to get out of these messy wars of occupation and go to sort of these secret wars. The other aspect that you raised is the technology had evolved so much that what in effect Obama was handed was this machine that by that point had been very finely calibrated for manhunting and killing. And so the intelligence about that led to drone strikes got better. That didn't mean that there weren't civilian casualties. There were a lot of them. But the CIA had committed more resources on the ground in Pakistan. And so it was by the time Obama came into power, he was very much he was able to order these types of operations in part because they were sort of ready-made for him.
And they were already set in place. And,
yeah.
And he inherited trying to get out of what had happened in Iraq. And he also inherited Afghanistan, which he thought might be more manageable and didn't realize how badly the U.S. was doing in that war. And many people feel it's really a rout at this stage that people are fleeing the country who know that it's all going to go down the tubes as more and more gets pulled out. But he didn't want to stop fighting. And in your book, the motivation, it seemed, for both the CIA and the Pentagon appeared to be about fighting the war, fighting the terrorists out there. But, you know, there was a huge pipeline that did manage to get laid across Afghanistan, and there are resources in the Niger where we're now putting a new drone base. What about that? What about the backdrop of global economic interests in these wars and this going to this cleaner, meaner killing machine, which a lot of the times is actually agreed to by the country, so not a violation of national sovereignty technically, but sometimes it is a violation of national sovereignty of other nations?
Well, it certainly is. This is a history of a lot of secret deals that have been cut between whether it's the Pakistani government, the Yemeni government, parts of the Pakistani government which approve of the strikes, parts of the Pakistani government which do not. You raised economic interest. I mean, certainly, you know, a lot of people would argue that the very reason we spend so much time worrying about the Middle East, of course, is economic interest and oil interest and our relationship with Saudi Arabia, which has been, you know, a cornerstone of American foreign policy for decades. I do talk about a secret base that was built in Saudi Arabia that the CIA built with the approval of the Saudi government, under the condition that it never came out that the Saudis that the base was in Saudi Arabia. But it's hard to hide a drone base, and it's hard to hide drone strikes. And one of the reasons why Yemen has been such a concern to the U.S. is not just because there have been individual militants who have tried to carry out attacks in the United States and elsewhere, but because there's such a focus of concern to the Saudis, because they're determined, this group is determined to try to overthrow the Saudi monarchy.
So in a way where this is an aid to our allies, our longtime allies there. Mark, you know, there were a couple, in the way that you wrote the book, you took particular incidents, some of which we've heard of it in the public before and some of which we haven't, and you used them as examples and you went from inside stories. So can you talk a little bit about your sources? Because I know there have been times when you've been criticized that your sources, that maybe you're a little too close to some of your sources, or that you accept a single source because you know the person, but does that really mean it's a valid source? Can you talk about your sources in general? And then I wanted to talk about this one case that really seemed to exemplify the changing methods, which was a gentleman that was killed in Somalia. I'm going to say his name wrong. Saleh Ali Saleh Nabhan.
That's correct.
So if you can talk about the issue about sources, and then as it relates to this case and others, you can do that as well.
Well, I could say it was certainly incredibly difficult story to report, a book to report. I didn't get any official help, that's for sure. It's hard when you're dealing in national security to know who to trust and know whose information to rely on. And so as much as possible, you want to obviously get it verified with others as well, and two, three, four sources. So little of this secret history has been declassified. And so you do have to rely on, in some cases, people who you have relied on over the years who have proven to be very valuable sources. At the same time, I wanted to tell an honest story and to not tell one story that had either a good or a bad ending. I think that it is so important that is in this age of secrecy, in this age of sort of this clampdown on information, to tell the American public what is happening and it is war, you know, how these wars are waged. So you do necessarily rely on anonymous sources more than you'd certainly like to. But
I will say the majority of your book, of course, is not anonymous sources. They're named sources and duplicate sources, and you say where they're backed up, and the notes are in the back. But in some cases where they're kind of controversial incidents, there'd be just one source, and so that, you know, would leave someone else a little bit more questioned. But what you're saying is that you've worked, you know, you're not putting something out there where you think you can't trust the source that you're dealing with.
Right. And I was just going to say that, you know, in this age where there's been such a crackdown on information and, you know, they're sending people to jail for leaking. I mean, this is all very serious. And I'm very, as I say in the back of the book, I'm incredibly grateful for the people who did agree to talk, because it's not a lot of times there's no benefit to them for doing it.
Thank you for mentioning that, too, because I believe there is James Risen, New York Times, and Eric Lichtblau. Both have suffered some real difficulty from a government that was angry about what they wrote and made life for some of who they thought were their sources very difficult. And so you're right, that is one of the risks that the people talking to you face and one of the risks that's there with you. And I think it's one of the reasons why it's so important that we still have reporters who are able to get on the inside and have people trust them enough for their integrity to tell them things we wouldn't otherwise hear. So I think that's the other side of that issue. Well, let's talk about this gentleman I was talking about in Somalia and that example and how it kind of shows this awkward transformation that's still not done.
So,
wasn't at that stage?
Right. I mean, one of the things that I talk about is how President Obama came in and one of his first acts was to shut down the CIA's secret prisons and interrogation program. Much of it was kind of a shadow of what it already had been. So there wasn't a whole lot there, but he made the statement shutting it down. He also said he was going to close Guantanamo Bay. And of course, that hasn't happened yet. But it did force some very uneasy decisions about what to do with people when you had hunted them. Do you capture them or do you kill them? And in the Narbonne case that you bring up, the Joint Special Operations Command had been tracking Narbonne around Somalia for some time. And then a decision is made, well, we're going to carry out an operation. The U.S. is going to carry out an operation. And what was initially approved was a missile strike on him. It was considered a lower
risk from a ship in the sea. Nearby.
That's correct, and it was and it was considered a better alternative than sending American troops in to go capture or kill him. Well, the mission was scrubbed at the last minute, and what happens is a team of Navy SEALs go in on helicopters to chase his convoy, and. And they kill him and everyone in his convoy, and then they drop down onto the ground and pick up DNA evidence or samples in order to prove that Narbonne was actually Narbonne. And the reason why I think the episode is illuminating is because it did create a lot of questions in the Pentagon and elsewhere about, well, if there's if you send people in, if you've already committed troops, why did they capture him and why did they kill him?
Which is a question some people still have about Osama bin Laden as well. They're you know, a question about, I would say, the Obama administration period is what about, you know, the rule of law? What about, you know, bring the corpse? You know, what about having a day in court when, and couldn't we win these cases, of course? You know, so why kill instead of capture?
Well, it's if you look at the numbers don't lie. If you look at in the last 5 years, the number of senior level militant, you know, slash terrorists who have been captured versus killed. I mean, there's only really a handful who, and then some of them are not even senior, who have been captured and then taken, you know, as we say, to trial in Manhattan or anywhere else. We ask a lot about this question, and we try to get to the bottom of it. And it's not black and white, but certainly there has been a move where killing has been seen as a cleaner, more risk-free option. And other reasons for the increase in killing versus capturing is, for instance, if you take Pakistan, the administration will argue, well, who's going to capture them? We could send American troops in, but that's a violation of sovereignty. There's no Pakistani police force in the tribal areas, so how are they going to get them? I think people do think about these things. I do think that these discussions are had, but when you drill down into individual cases, sometimes it does raise questions about, well, there did seem to be plausible scenarios for a person being captured.
Yes, and I want to go back even to, well, who's giving the okay on these people being killed, and how has that changed during this time? Who's sitting there? Is there someone every time we send a drone to kill a target? And I want to say that at least in one case you cited it was 3 out of 25 got their targets. So we know there's incredible human loss all over the world, everywhere we send drones. We know that humans that were not necessarily in any way involved in the actions that we find a threat to the United States. And yet we use – that got me off in my mind, even on the drones. But back to your book, it seems to me that with the drones, it looks cleaner and and better. Do you know what I mean? We killed this person, but who's overseeing that? Who's the second guesser? Who's saying that was even someone we really needed to kill?
So it depends on the...
Without habeas corpus, without any trial, I know there's these meetings that take place. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Have they always been there?
There's been meeting. So it's evolved where in Pakistan, for instance, the CIA has the authority to go to pull the trigger. The CIA director can authorize a drone strike. But in the Obama administration, one thing that has been set out is anywhere beyond Pakistan, if the U.S. military or CIA is going to carry out a lethal operation, there's got to be more discussion at the White House. And so there's a team that comes that sort of decides on these things. And it used to be led by John Brennan, who was the CIA – sorry, the counterterrorism advisor to President Obama, now the CIA director. And so they would make individual decisions that would ultimately go to President Obama, for instance, in Yemen, about whether to carry out a strike. The idea being in part that it's a much smaller sample size, and so the president could sign off on each one, whereas as we know in Pakistan, there's been hundreds of strikes. So – But one of the bigger issues I raise in the book is, you know, when you're carrying out secret war or when the CIA is at war, you're necessarily going to sort of short circuit the normal ways of how the U.S. goes to war. It's a small group of people making decisions about life and death. The CIA always has prided itself on having this direct line to the White House. So the CIA director to the National Security Advisor to the president. The fewer number of people who are having oversight over individual operations or deciding whether this is a good or bad idea, you know, inevitably the greater the risk for cautionary voices, you know, not being heard. Or, I mean, as much as people criticize the big lumbering Pentagon, what the big lumbering bureaucratic Pentagon has is layers and layers of people who are studying operations and things like that. And so that's I think a big difference. And so there is a concern that this sort of leaner, meaner, as you said, scaled down secret war does have an oversight problem.
Which I think is extremely important. Now, obviously, from my own political perspective, I think that we shouldn't be killing anyone without, transparency for the reasons and the right kind of structures of government. I believe in a traditional trial, but those are different in different countries. So we'll leave it to other people to figure out that part of it. I wanted to talk about another particular incident. It showed a different aspect of how these two different armies going on. And you mentioned, you know, you talk a lot about the CIA, but my understanding is the JSOC, the Pentagon's, you know, or what's called Obama's private army sometimes, has actually carried out hundreds more strikes than the CIA, I think, I heard 10 times more drone strikes than the CIA. But these two armies are going on. They're both secret armies, and they carry out special operations. And they both carried out operations in a really noteworthy case, and this was the case of al-Awlaki. And his son. Will you talk about those and how that one unfolded? You have revelations throughout your book, many more than these, but this was one that was fairly interesting.
Sure. So Anwar al-Awlaki was a cleric who was born in the United States in New Mexico and attended college in the United States, and then to truncate his biography significantly, ended up in Britain and then in Yemen, and increasingly preaching more militant strains of radical Islam, and developed something of a cult following through YouTube and the internet in English language sermons. The Obama administration really he came on the Obama administration's radar in around 2009 to 2010, when he seemed to have some kind of a role with Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is the Al Qaeda affiliated group in Yemen, and he sort of became public enemy number one for the Obama administration. There was a belief that he played a role in sending the young Nigerian man who tried to blow up Obama blow up an airplane on Christmas Day, 2009. So throughout 2010 and 2011, even while the planning for the Bin Laden raid was going on, there was this manhunt for al-Awlaki. And the CIA and the Pentagon both they ramp up their resources in order to hunt and kill al-Awlaki. And there's a number of near misses. And then in September 2011, we mentioned the drone base in Saudi Arabia. In September 2011, a group of CIA drones took off from that base and had just been built, and they hunted and killed Alaki, who was in a northern part of Yemen. That was a CIA operation. There was some military involvement, but it was primarily the CIA carrying it out.
So so it was a drone that hit a convoy or a truck, correct, and killed everyone in it, and they went down and got the DNA.
That's correct. Someone did. I'm not sure who did get the DNA, but the drones hit the convoy, and okay, Alaki was confirmed dead. President Obama came out and confirmed he was dead.
Which was the first American citizen to be openly targeted and assassinated by our own government, as far as I know historically.
I don't know of a previous case. If you're setting aside the Civil War, which is a whole nother case.
Well, yeah,
a whole
nother
case.
I know. Yep, there you go.
But yeah. So it was an extraordinary moment. I mean, there had been a lot of discussion in the Obama administration. There had been a secret legal memo that had been signed by the Justice Department authorizing this, and so it was a moment. And President Obama came out and confirmed it. Interestingly, 2 weeks later, another drone strike, this one carried out by the military, by JSOC, killed Alaki's 16-year-old son, another American citizen who had been born in Denver when his father
Who wasn't a threat.
No, and who wasn't a threat. There's still more to be learned about this case, but nobody I've spoken to has said at all that they believed that Abdulrahman Alaki had militant ties or anything like that. It was a deadly mistake, and that he was in the wrong place at the wrong time in this part. He had gone out to search for his father and was on his way back to Sana'a, Yemen, when he heard his father had been killed. He was on his way back, and he was killed in the process. So this is really the closing chapter of my book, to sort of describe how both the CIA and the military had converged in one country, and the work of the soldiers and the work of spies had blurred so much. And you had here this sort of extraordinary moment where both American citizen and his son are both killed by different branches of the government.
Yes. Well, you know, in talking about these drone wars, you were focusing a lot on this kind of scenario, letting us see or inside where the conflicts were happening. But what you don't see is, like, in Yemen, there are hundreds of thousands of displaced people who are fleeing drones. There were 53 drone strikes last year, I think Holder said in his list, in Yemen alone. Whew, that's a lot of drone strikes. And the populations where they are very intimidated and fearful. I know the International Red Cross has gone on. I've spoken to Yemenis who say there's a real crisis there. So as we're looking forward, Mark Mazzetti, author of The Way of the Knife, the CIA, a Secret Army, and the War at the Ends of the Earth, I really want to say I think it's a really intriguing book, really thoroughly documented in the back, and a lot of good information. So I do appreciate it. But here we are in this situation where there are, to me, it feels like drones gone amok, no central oversight other than the president's office. It all rests with, you know, what many begin to call an imperial model. You know, it all rests sitting there with the executive. Even when this executive leaves, a newer and even faster and better of whatever this is will exist. How do you see this going in the future? And what do countries like Yemen and now Niger and Sudan and Kenya and Somalia, other places where we're heading our drones? And it seems to me there won't be an end of targets because it's raising a lot of new militants. You mentioned that in your book. Many people say there are more terrorists flooding to become terrorists as a result.
There is certainly, on the first part of your question, there's no doubt that this will continue. And whether the CIA stays at the forefront of this, or whether, as John Brennan, the CIA director, has indicated, he'd like the CIA to be getting out of the paramilitary business to some degree. I don't think the CIA is going to be giving this up entirely. I think the drone wars will continue, whether it's the military or the CIA that carries them out. In some ways, there's really a distinction without a difference. I think the question that we're going to see going forward is there blowback? Is the have American activities created radicalized people who weren't radicalized before. This has raised concern in the American government about if they're not just killing senior al-Qaeda leaders and going after low-level people and in some cases killing civilians, you know, is the cost worth the benefit? And I think that this is something that we're going to have to keep on and keep focusing on for many years, because we're maybe just seeing the beginning of it. We'll see what drives people toward radicalization. We saw in 2010, Faisal Shahzad, who tried to blow up Times Square with a truck bomb. He was unsuccessful, but he went to court and he said the reason why he had done it was because of the drone strikes in Pakistan. So it's it's complicated, but I don't think these issues are going away.
No, I think that we'll only see more complications. And maybe I wanted to ask you almost here at the very end of our interview, what do you think about ground troops? Are we going to really see those begin to disappear, the traditional army, or will the entrenched military hang on as long as they can? I mean, of course they will do that, but will we begin to see the traditional military in its different forms go away?
I think that, certainly in this age of budget cuts and all that, you're going to see you're already seeing a shift towards more of these operations as opposed to large, divisions and keeping the army in its current size. I think it's partly budget drives it. And secondly, it's also national mood. And at least right now, it's hard to imagine the nation wanting to get behind any kind of war similar to Iraq and Afghanistan anytime soon. And the Obama administration knows that. So it's hard to look around the world right now and see another heavy ground-intensive war like anytime in the next decade. And, it's always foolish to make predictions, but it does seem that this model is something that will be much more the way of the future, at least the immediate future, than anything we've seen, for instance, in Iraq.
Well, thank you for that. Well, there was so much more to ask you about, including the role of private contractors, which is a huge, huge part of what's going on in the world and a part that you have addressed in your book. Thank you so much for joining us here at KBOO, Mark Mazzetti.
I really appreciate you having me.
And it's 10 o'clock at KBOO Portland. Good morning. Coming up in 15 minutes on Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 today on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews celebrated author Karen Russell, who was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction last year for her debut novel Swamplandia. And at 11:30, it's The Film Show with Jen Chavez and SW Concert. That's all coming up this morning on KBOO. But first, it's headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre on Air Cascadia. And that is coming up now on KBOO.
Morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, April 25th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Well, the Los Angeles City Council has voted unanimously to ask federal regulators not to allow the restart of the San Onofre nuclear reactors without formal public process. They tried to slip that one through. Again, the privatization, the corporatization of the public forum has been stymied. This doesn't happen very often these days. CISPA sailed through the House yesterday despite a White House veto threat and an outcry from privacy advocates and civil liberties groups. And Israel is back to its unique style of rumor mongering and in its push towards that red line, drones, chemical weapons, and more. Just waiting on the red line. Okay, first this from the National Weather Service: sunny with a high near 75 today. Calm winds becoming northwest, 5 to 9 miles per hour in the morning. Tonight mostly clear with a low around 48. Northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Friday, tomorrow, Sunday, sunny with a high near 80, calm wind becoming west around 5 miles per hour in the afternoon, and Friday night increasing clouds with a low around 49, northwest winds 5, and becoming calm, dropping off in the evening. Our alternative outlook, we have a full flower moon in Libra, 14 days old. The cyanotic outlook, now is a good time to sow root vegetables, berries, bulbs, onions, biennials, and perennials. Don't forget, we're going to be into a waning moon starting out this evening. So now's a good time, according to the cyanotic farmers, to sow root vegetables. Also, agreeing again, as it often does, with cyanotic forecast, the biodynamic outlook with moon in Libra. It's an air sign, a good time to sow flowering plants. And things like shallots, spring onions, swedes, turnips, that sort of thing that you very likely have if you do winter gardening, farming, growing. Those things should be harvested and eaten straight away. The sidereal forecast moon in Virgo, dry and barren, good time for garden maintenance. And indeed it is. I would recommend, if you have a huge amount of land or even several acres, to make compost piles in the areas that you plan to be working in the next 6 to 12 months. That way you've got everything you need right there. And that's it for the alternative forecast and for the conventional National Weather Service outlook. We have local stories today, and of course everything being a net sensitive dependence on initial conditions certainly applies, as does, of course, pattern recognition. It's through pattern recognition that we are able to look at local events and map that onto the world stage, thereby understanding events with a little bit more vertical depth, as opposed to just the broad approach that mainstream media has embraced. It has to start somewhere, and it's starting everywhere. The coming water wars will put to shame all of the prior instances of social upheaval, such as they are at this point in America. For years, voices on the left have been calling for a general strike. Water might be the trigger, not just because of climate catastrophe, which is taking place in slow motion all around us, and not so slow motion in many cases, flooding in places that don't often see high water marks this time of year. So it isn't just because of the climate change